Welcome to the Eastman Dental Podcast, where we hope to inspire, motivate, and provide education from our guests' experience.
This week's guest has a real journey to share with us.
Yeah, and actually a very moving story, Josh, I'd say.
And Barbara was only 32 when she was diagnosed with tongue cancer. And she talks about that whole process as well as what she's gone on to do afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, setting up a community charity to help people in a similar situation to her is quite groundbreaking.
And I think whoever you are, dental professional or otherwise, this is a really great episode. So tune in and listen.
With your hosts, Josh Hudson and Julia Bruin.
Welcome to the Eastman Dental Podcast, Barbara. It's really good to have you on board.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are interviewing patients and we are trying to get into the mindset of our patients, trying to get a bit of a feel about what we might be able to do differently, how we can support our patients. So try and tell us a little bit about yourself in the general dental sense and about who we're dealing with, perhaps.
Okay, I shall try. So my name is Barbara Fountain. I'm actually originally from Switzerland. So I was born in Switzerland, grew up there, and then moved to the UK in 2007. So well over 15 years now. I've always had very good dental health. I had braces when I was young. My teeth are fairly straight. My parents have spent a very big amount of money to make sure that I had healthy teeth. In 2018, just shortly I've got engaged, I noticed that I had an ulcer on my tongue and nothing was moving. It wasn't getting any better, wasn't getting any worse. And after seeing a pharmacist and waiting a few weeks, I was advised to go and see my dentist to see what can be done about it. I saw my dentist. I am based in Norwich and I'm very lucky that I'm able to have an NHS dentist. We have a bit of a dental crisis going on locally. And my dentist saw me, looked at it, wasn't the overly concerned because he could see one of my teeth was at a slight angle, which was rubbing with the ulcer. But scheduled me to come back within a couple of weeks, which I did. Again, wasn't too sure. Looked at my history, my health history. I had been a smoker in my teens, but not in my adult life, not for a long time. But I was generally healthy. And he removed a bit of my teeth in order to reduce the rubbing and then asked me to come back again, which I did. And at that point, he said, look, I'm really sorry, but I have to refer you on to the local oral health department at the hospital. And he was, very frank with me. He said, look, there's nothing to worry about. You're too young for it to be anything sinister.
What sort of age are we talking about you being here?
I was 32 at the time. And so he just sent me on my merry way. I went there. I saw an ENT at least three times. I was asked to come back. So they sort of observed what was happening. And then again, at the end, it was basically the exact same conversation going, we're really sorry, but just for best practice, we need to take a biopsy at this point. We're not concerned. You don't fit the profile for anything sinister. It's quite interesting that they only ever use the word sinister and not the C word. And I say, oh, okay, yeah, biopsy, fine. I must admit, cancer was not on my radar until I had the biopsy and the consultant performing the biopsy looked at it as like, oh, no, it's definitely not cancer. It's nothing to be concerned about. And I was laying there with my mouth open going, oh, didn't realise that was on the menu. So that's good to know. So went away. I have to admit the biopsy was a very unpleasant experience, but we can go into that later on. And then, had Christmas, healed, came back for my follow-up, which was on New Year's Eve. 31st of December 2018. My husband and I fell asleep in the waiting room. We were totally relaxed, got in. I should have taken a clue out of the room being pretty crammed with lots of different people. I sat down and a consultant called Mr. James asked me loads of questions about what made you go and see your dentist, what made you come and see us with the ulcer. And I must admit, I was sitting there thinking, oh, he's going to tell me I'm a huge hypochondriac and all these people are here to take me away. And I was honestly, I was feeling like pretty foolish and going like, oh my God, what have I done? But he then actually said, well, I'm really glad you did those things because it's bad news. You've got cancer. And like I said, we didn't actually realise cancer was an option here. So both me and my then fiancé were very shocked. I sort of went pragmatic and went, oh, tongue cancer, that's a bit weird. And said, what happens next? You know, I said, oh, I need to go to Germany in a few days. Can I still go? And he's like, oh, no, better for you to hang around. So from a dental perspective, that was it. I didn't have any more interactions with my dentist once I was diagnosed. But as I have found out retrospectively, is I am deeply, deeply grateful that my dentist followed best practice, even though he didn't believe it was necessary. He just was apologetic about it, said it'll all be fine, off you go on your way. If he would have stuck what he thought was right instead of the guidelines, my diagnosis would have been delayed, which would have meant I would have had a worse outcome and a bigger detrimental impact on my quality of life.
Wow. And from there ensues a whole load of things, and I'm sure we're going to get into those. But one thing that you mentioned there was the discussion about things being sinister, the lack of use of the word cancer. And it brings me back to, in one of my jobs, we did some work about these patients being referred in urgently, and a lot of patients weren't turning up to those appointments. And we were thinking, why aren't they turning up? Have they been told that this is something that's serious? And we looked into it, and most of the time the dentists were saying, I'm referring you to the hospital, but they hadn't said, because I'm really concerned and it's really important that you go to this appointment. So I guess from your point of view, in hindsight, was that the right way? Would you have preferred to have some kind of, this could be on the cards, it's probably not? How would you have preferred people to approach that? Or were you happy for that to be the case, and then you just have that kind of shock of finding it out at that diagnosis point?
It's a really good question. I mean, I can't rewrite history. So, and I'm quite content the way my journey has gone and my story has gone. It allowed me to have a very joyful Christmas period with my entire family without worrying.
Yeah.
I didn't have the type of anxiety that I've had to deal with since in terms of recurrence. So yes, I'm actually quite glad that happened. On the flip side, psychologically, it's had a huge impact on my mental health. I find it really difficult to believe my team when they say, you're okay, there is no cancer there. It's not going to come back. Statistically, it's really, really unlikely. I'm like, yeah, but it was statistically really, really unlikely that I got it in the first place. And also this, I think this, what's also is the compound impact of several people saying, just referring to the word, it's not nothing sinister, and not using the word cancer, means that now when I get reassurances that I am healthy and fine and the future will be okay, I find it really difficult to believe that. And I will nod and go, yeah, thank you. But yeah, and it also translates into when I was told I was in remission, I didn't have a little dance. I was like, yeah, cool, bye. And my other half was like, are you not happy about this? I was like, well, no, why should I be? Like, I didn't want it in the first place. I'm not bouncing off the ceilings of this because I know it could come back at any moment. So I'm not celebrating this yet. Yeah, I sometimes find it really difficult to decide how to describe myself. either as a patient or a survivor. And I've come to the conclusion that actually I will never be a survivor until I've died of something else.
Well, it is really lovely to have you on the podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
I mean, I think as sort of medical and dental people, it's very difficult to get into the mindset of a patient. I mean, we try and think about the words that we use, how we communicate, how we impart that sort of information, and how we have those what might be considered difficult conversations with patients. So do you think, from what I'm gathering, you perhaps weren't clear about what was going on? Do you think people should have been a little bit more obvious with their wording?
Yeah, I think what's actually more interesting about this question is I don't think my dentist expected it to be cancer. And I got confirmation of that when I went back for my first checkup a year and a half later. And I said, oh, by the way, I had tongue cancer. And I mean, the poor man went white. He is quite a senior dentist, has been in the business for a very long time. And he was perplexed and said, I've never come across a tongue cancer patient, let alone you. You don't fit the image. So I genuinely believe that the people that were referring me on weren't referring me on because they were worried I had cancer. They were worried that I had a different immune problem or a fungal infection or something that just wasn't in their wheelhouse to deal with. They needed an expert to have a look at it. Mm. In terms of once I was in the clinical setting with an ENT, I obviously don't know what the thinking was. I have to believe that they have enough knowledge to at least suspect that, especially once they refer for a biopsy. I think mentioning the word cancer and mentioning that that is a possibility, although it may be unlikely, is important. It allows a person to mentally prepare themselves for what might happen. At the same time, I don't think it would be very healthy to stress that point too much, because there's a statistic I was informed of the other day that actually only about 11% of people who get referred for suspected oral cancer actually have got oral cancer. So we do also have to be mindful of the percentage of people who are not diagnosed with oral cancer, because going through a test for suspected cancer is incredibly stressful for anyone, no matter where what body part the cancer
impacts. Yeah, no, that's a fair point, isn't it?
So I think, yes, mention it lightly, unlikely statistically, but we just need to rule it out.
Yeah.
I think that would be the better type of wording to use, yes.
Yeah, so mention it, but give an appropriate level of concern based on what you're seeing. That makes a lot of sense. I think that's useful advice for anyone listening. And then to take you back to that point, so you received that diagnosis and then obviously a whole host of things would have happened from there. How much did you understand what was being told to you in those early days? Was everything clear? Do you feel like it was well explained, or do you think that that could have been improved upon?
So I'm really lucky. I have a Max Fax surgeon who is very to the point, shall we say. I love him. He's great. And he just doesn't dilly-dally around anything and he will give it to you straight. So on the very day of diagnosis, it is hard to take anything else in other than the word cancer.
Yeah.
I personally, so my professional background is I'm an event manager. So I'm someone who takes control, organises, plans, does lists. So the questions I asked, I think, took them all by surprise, because I was very much, okay, right, what's next? Help me build my list, help me take control. Whereas on the other side, my husband next to me were just blubbering away. And I actually went, will you stop crying, please? I need to concentrate here. And it was only later on. And again, I think that was a very good move by the Norfolk and Norwich. They had a Macmillan nurse within the oral department. So before they sent me home or sent me for more tests, they introduced me to my Macmillan nurse. She sat me down in another room, said, "I'll get you a cup of tea." And she did the hand on the shoulder. And that's when I went, "Oh my God, yes." That's when I registered. A Macmillan nurse is holding my shoulder. This is real. And I think it took that 45 minutes for my brain to go, okay, this is not a work project. This is not a moment where you can be a swan and pedal underneath and be absolutely fine. This is real. And then it is what I found, what I personally found really reassuring. After that, I straight away went for x-rays, for bloods, had my next appointment already in the books, and I felt on a conveyor belt. And for me personally, that was, I took a lot of confidence out of that, because I felt, yes, I'm looked after. This is taken seriously. I don't have to make my voice heard. I can lean on the medical profession to take care of that. I can go home, break the news, do the emotional work, do the life admin, you know, hand over all my passwords, make my plans in case anything goes wrong, and then just be ready for what comes next. At the time, that was a big question mark, of course. And when they did eventually explain, so this was after the multidisciplinary team meeting, when they did eventually explain about having a partial glossectomy with neck dissection and pieces of your arm going into your mouth and pieces of your leg going into your arm, it took me a quick second to take that one in. And I ended up with a lot more questions than what I had answers available to me.
So leading on from that, it might seem a rather ridiculous question to ask, but I'm going to ask it. Did you feel well prepared for your treatment?
Yes and no. No, because at the time, I, from my personal point of view, made the decision not to engage with Dr. Google. I left that to my husband and my parents, and by their reaction, they were so mortified, I didn't want to know. I am a person who's quite a smiley, happy, bubbly, positive person, and I knew that I had to protect myself from information that might be harmful and would take away any strength that I needed in order to get through this. I feel that I knew enough in the sense that this is going to be incredibly hard. It's going to be painful. It's going to be frustrating. And I made some conscious decisions for myself. So between diagnosis and surgery were 5 weeks. I'm personally actually quite grateful for those 5 weeks because it allowed me to go to the local Buddhist center and learn to meditate, which I did every day. It allowed me to get myself organized and to adapt a mindset that would help me get through this experience. And I also had a really strange reaction to getting a cancer diagnosis, whereas I probably felt the happiest I had ever been in my life. I know that's a strange thing to say, but I know that a lot of my peers go through a similar experience in the sense that it took something quite catastrophic for me to realise that I was a good human and that I was loved. That in itself is quite sad, but I'm also hugely grateful that I've been able to have that experience now, and that I am able to take those emotions and move on with them and actually appreciate, I guess, what I have and what I've achieved a lot more. So, you know, when I had inner monologues with myself of thinking, okay, well, if this is it, are you okay with that? The answer was yes. And I thought, actually, when you look at life as a whole, that you, and you're able to say at the end, okay, I've had a great inning. I had a fantastic time. I am really loved. There's not much more that I can do. So I was able to give myself into this process. And also, I think the hardest thing for me was I knew I had to let go and hand over all control to my healthcare team. And that includes, you know, the many, many surgeons in those rooms. Mm. That includes the nurses, the specialists, the speech language therapists, and so on. That I just had to hand over total control and just allow them to look after me. And I think that was the hardest part.
I think what you're saying there is a privilege to hear and listen. And I think Josh and I would both say thank you so much for sharing that. But I want to just sort of say something just to tag on to the end of that, really, that you felt that way. But I think that some people who are living with people who have a cancer diagnosis, whether it would be the mouth or any other part of the body, that actually this is also their opportunity to show you how much you are cared, adored, loved, supported. And so it can be a very positive experience, can't it? And you've just described yours.
Absolutely. I also want to acknowledge that it can go completely the other way.
Well, yes.
And also, you know, I am lucky enough to be here, sitting here at the moment with, as far as we're aware, no cancer within me, and have come through it the other side. I wouldn't say unscathed, but in quite good shape and good nick. I know that that would have been severely challenged if I would have had to continue on with treatment or deal with recurrences, or have my prognosis was pretty good, have a different prognosis. So I just also want to acknowledge that, I guess, my situation may be unique to myself. Mm-hmm. I know other people have similar experiences, but I also know lots of other people have lots of different experiences, which are just as valid.
Yeah. So after that 5 week period that you mentioned, you had the surgery. Presumably that was the surgery that you mentioned that they initially told you that you were going to have, and you've gone through that, come out the other side, as you've mentioned. And then at some point in that process, you've made this decision to set up this community. So this community for younger people with tongue cancer. And where did that come about? What inspired you? Where was the point where you decided, actually, I'm going to take my experience and I'm going to do this thing to help other people?
Absolutely. So the community is called the Young Tongues. Mm-hmm. And the reason it came about was for 100% selfish reasons. My experience following the surgery, once I, let's say, it came out of the woods of my own storm and recovery, and then started having regular checkups, for me, 6 weekly, so very regular for years. Mm-hmm. So still going to the hospital as we speak. I felt so isolated. And I felt so lonely because I was sitting in a room surrounded by people I couldn't identify with. Tongue cancer largely affects the elderly population. And I just felt like an anomaly. I felt like a mistake. I felt I didn't have a home. When I visited support groups for mouth cancer, head and neck cancer, the room was full of people who were towards the end of their life, mm-hmm. not in the middle of it.
That classic group of patients.
Yes, and they were difficult. They were difficult experiences to have because I immediately realised that I was going to come out of this way better than anyone else sitting in this room, and at the same time, I wasn't able to voice the challenges that I was facing. So I had my own events company. I was finding it really challenging to return to work. I was having severely financial difficulties in getting the right support, getting the right type of benefit, continuously being told no after asking for help. You don't fit all the boxes, you aren't entitled to X, Y, Z. Mm. Also, other topics that wouldn't be relevant to someone in their 80s, relationships, family planning, sexuality, intimacy, ambitions, fatigue, all those things that impact your life just differently. Not saying one is more valid than the other, just differently. I was lucky enough that I was able to connect with other young cancer patients through Shine Cancer Support. But again, I found a bit of camaraderie, but we all had so different cancers. No one had head and neck cancer, so there was no one who could really relate to where I was. And I also had this impression, and I know this is going to sound awful, I arrived at Shine and I would introduce myself as, I didn't really have proper cancer because I didn't have radiation or chemo, my hair didn't fall out. And for a really long time, I didn't feel like entitled to be a cancer patient. But people would tell me, but no, you've had like part of your body removed. Like that's a big deal. And I think what didn't help, and this is maybe a little bit of a criticism in terms of communication with my medical team, is I was told that I would be back to normal within 3 weeks. 3 months, not 3 weeks. That'd be spectacular. But I would be back to normal within 3 months. And I measured myself against that. And when I still felt fatigued after 3 months and I was battling with mental health challenges, I felt totally inadequate. I felt like a bad patient. I felt like, am I making this all up? Am I being difficult? So I didn't have the community who got it.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward, pandemic, there's this thing called Zoom pops up. There's also this amazing thing called Instagram, which a lot of people, you know, talk negatively about, but actually it does a whole load of good because you're able to connect with people that may have been through a similar experience as you. And that's what I did. I found two girls in America, one in California, one on the eastern side of America. They knew other people. And I said, hey, let's just jump on a Zoom. And we sent like emails out and there were eight of us on a Zoom call. And I think at the time we were called the Tongue Cancer Babes because we couldn't come up with a better word for it. And straight away from the off, that call was one of the best things I have ever done. The laughter, the, oh my God, can I see your scar? Your scar looks the same as me. Look at your arm. Oh my God, why is your neck scar like higher? Ah, so it's not so, oh, amazing. And like the chatter was just out of this world. It was so fast, so overexcited, but just so wholesome of being able to exchange those experiences and looking other people in the eyes who got it. And every time anyone said everything, the other eight faces on the Zoom call was like nodding away again. Yes, totally. So I couldn't sleep that night. And the next morning I shot off out of bed. I was like, young tongues. And my husband thought I sort of lost my mind temporarily. And that was it. That was it. And from that moment on, set up Facebook groups, Twitter, all the other social media, websites, set up an email. That was all done within 6 hours. Sent out a message, we've got this now. And then the message carried on. We're now 2 years in, our community has grown to over 500. Every week we have an average 6 to 8 new patients asking to join like the private group. And that was the realization that I just came to, is like, there's lots more people like me. I'm not that rare. And actually, the more the conversations then started to take hold, I realised, oh my God, this is a whole section of patients who are underserved and are not getting the support that they need. So I guess that's when I took it upon me to be that voice, because I have to say, not everyone has their voice anymore. Mm. I am very privileged that I can speak, that I can eat, that I can swallow. I had no idea how rare stage one was, especially within my own community of young tongue cancer patients. So I really felt we need to shine a light on this community and we need to make sure that the correct support resources are available for healthcare providers as well, because you know, all the leaflets I got were aimed at 80-year-olds and, you know, I'm not 80. Mm-hmm. So to be able to create that content and to make it available to the healthcare profession so, you know, we can help you help us, that's really what we're trying to achieve.
So this charity now?
Yes, very new charity. Yeah.
So this charity, this community, this support group is doing all sorts of things. Mm. And I just think it would be helpful for you to tell the listeners what it's specifically perhaps doing for patients like yourself who've had experiences, but whether you're doing things to sort of spread the news around perhaps dental and medical professionals.
Absolutely. I'll cover off the objectives first. I was quite surprised that when we sent our objectives into the Charity Commission, they actually came back and wanted to add some more. So I was like, okay, thank you very much. But I think the primary thing that we do is peer-to-peer support. So we have a private Facebook group. We've got WhatsApp groups where only patients and survivors are allowed. And it's a community that fosters itself. We have very strict community rules, so we don't give medical advice, but we do share our own experience. And the power in that is that when someone asks a very specific question, for example, about a side effect, you will get 30 different answers. And that's really important when it comes to tongue cancer, because each individual's experience is so different and it can range from the worst possible imaginable experience to actually not that bad. And I think it's really important for a patient, especially someone who's been newly diagnosed, to realise there's a spectrum and that they will probably fall somewhere within that spectrum. And I think it gives people confidence and it helps take a bit the anxiety away that it doesn't have to be the worst case scenario all the time. It also takes away the loneliness and it allows people who find themselves in similar situations to link up and buddy up. So we have women who are pregnant at the time of diagnosis. Really important for a pregnant woman to be able to connect with another woman who's been through pregnancy with the diagnosis, to provide some reassurance and to provide a bit of foresight of what may happen. Mm-hmm. The other thing or things that we're doing or our ambition is to do is to create the support content downloadable from our website for healthcare professionals. As I've mentioned, we've been registered for a matter of weeks and that's in the works and it will be with you soon. And we have now also started a support group for supporters of people with tongue cancer, or young people with tongue cancer. And again, that has been in existence of a matter of weeks, but has already got over 100 people within the community and really some fantastic conversations going on within it. It's quite interesting for me to see it from the other side. Mm-hmm. I try not to get myself involved in it, but just from an observing point of view.
Well, I think it gives a joined up picture of that sort of situation, doesn't it? When you see from both sides of the story there.
So obviously we're dental professionals. A lot of the people listening are going to be dental professionals. And you're now in this unique position where you've got this group of people who can tell you about their experiences with dentists and dental professionals. So what kind of things are coming from within that group in relation to their dental experience? And is there anything that you can share with our listeners that might be beneficial in that aspect?
Yes. And allow me to tell you, please brace yourself. I am very sorry. Unfortunately, there is a story that we hear over and over and over again. And it's particularly surrounding young female patients, but also male, I have to say. It goes across the board. We have so many patients that come and report back and say, I have seen 3 different dentists. I have paid privately to go and see an ENT because I was not being listened to. and I was getting the same feedback over and over again. You don't fit the profile. It is most definitely not cancer. Mm-hmm. And these are patients not being referred to specialists within the hospital setting. And we did a little survey. To be fair, the survey is about a year old, so the community was a lot smaller. But a staggering 80% didn't get a diagnosis for 12 months. With squamous cell carcinoma of the tongue, that is dangerous. It spreads incredibly fast. And you're then talking about, instead of having a stage one diagnosis, going straight in for a stage four diagnosis. Still curable at stage four. Many people don't know that. But the impact it has on quality of life after is significant and severe. And I think it's, I appreciate that in the current climate, it's incredibly difficult to be a dentist. I would not want to be a dentist. I do not envy you at all. I think we all know the pressures that you are under. We all know that you are undervalued within the healthcare system. Let's be honest, most people don't want to go and see their dentist. But you are so, so important. And you are in the driving seat of recognising oral cancers and getting people diagnosed early. I would really like to challenge everyone listening that if you think you know what a head and neck cancer patient looks like, or a tongue cancer patient, or a mouth cancer patient, I am challenging you to rethink. You will be having not only in general more people coming through your doors with suspected oral cancer, but you'll be having more people coming through in all shapes and sizes, in all ages. So I don't envy you. It's a really difficult job. I understand we don't want to overwhelm the other side of, you know, the other side of the coin who have to do all the biopsies. But delaying a potential diagnosis has such a detrimental impact, not just in survival rates, but also quality of life. And we do need to talk about that quality of life aspect, not talked about enough. The difference between my dentist sending me or waiting for a few months is the fact that I am able to communicate clearly, loudly, without any pain, without any dry mouth, without any discomfort. I am able to swallow, I am able to eat. This allows me to have a fairly normal life. I can work, I can be productive. Ultimately, I can give back. And if that wouldn't have happened, I think I would be really struggling right now to just exist. And I see that with a lot of my peers. Everyone in my community is incredibly positive, incredibly tough and resilient. But when you're given a glimpse behind the curtain of how things really are, it's tough. It's brutal. Radiation to the head and neck is brutal. So if we can avoid people having to go through that process in the first place, from a prevention perspective, we are saving people's livelihoods and lives. And also we're saving a lot of money for the NHS, because anyone who's gone through radiation is going to have continued health issues for the rest of their life. And for someone who's diagnosed in their 20s or 30s, hopefully that is still a very big chunk of time left to live.
Yeah.
You're saying many, many things, Barbara, that I think will resonate with lots of people listening. I mean, we're very grateful for your input here on the podcast. I'm just sitting here thinking, I mean, clearly you've said every patient is so different. Every clinical situation will have different treatment outcomes, all sorts of differences there. But do you think that there are any sort of top tips that you may be able to share with us that then the listeners who are essentially going to be dental, I mean, this is a dental careers podcast, but we're doing a little sideline on talking to patients.
whether you think that there are any tips that you would be able to give that they can then share with their patients.
Yes, so I think the general guidance is really clear. If you have a lump or an ulcer in your mouth and it hasn't healed within 3 weeks, it's something to be taken seriously. Doesn't mean it's cancer, but something isn't right. And I would be over the moon to hear from our patients that when they go and present with an ulcer or something in their mouth that hasn't healed for more than 3 weeks, that they don't get dismissed and that they get heard and that they're not offered up a whole load of different potentials. You know, oh, it could be hormones. Oh, are you having menopause? Oh, do you have a fungal infection? Have you tried antibiotics? Da, 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 da. Not helpful. Just, and I understand that you probably don't want to do a referral straight away, but book them back in the following week and the following week. And if this still hasn't improved, if it hasn't changed, you do the referral. And don't be scared of it. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to understand what the negative impact of making a referral could possibly be on a dentist.
It's that phrase, isn't it, where if you hear hooves outside, it's probably a horse, but what about the zebra that might be in that group? There might be something happening that you're not expecting. And I do occasionally spend time sitting on the head and neck cancer MDT, and the story of patients having recurrent prescriptions of antibiotics, antifungals over a long period to then end up with a cancer diagnosis. It's just being pragmatic and thinking, does this make sense? Mm. This is the second course of antibiotics. Nothing's changing. You know, and doing that referral, like you said, there's no harm in doing that. And I think early diagnosis is so crucial, as you've already talked about. So I think that's really useful to mention.
And just to add to that, I think when it comes to the antibiotics and the fungals, quite often I have found that that's because the patient went via a GP.
Yeah, 100%.
And our advice is always go and see a dentist, because a dentist understands the mouth. Yeah. You know, nothing against GPs. They do a fantastic job, but they aren't experts when it comes to oral health. And also, it's very interesting to know that actually statistically in a GP's lifetime of being a GP, they will probably only come across one single head and neck cancer patient in their entire professional career, which is, you know, then understandable that they probably wouldn't pick up on those signs and symptoms.
So you're doing Young Tongues. This is, like you've described, a new charity. New charities need fundraising, need funds to do their wonderful, amazing work. And clearly you are right at the start of your career with this charity. How are you going about doing fundraising for this group?
Yeah, so we're really lucky that we have a partner called the Oracle Cancer Trust. They're a head and neck cancer charity. I have to also just mention I do also work for them as their fundraising and communications officer. But they've been really helpful to help us set up the Young Tongues Fund. That means that they manage our funds for us, but that we are able to have a platform to at least fundraise, because you would not believe how difficult it is to get a bank account and insurance set up for a new charity. It's just, you know, the admin side of it. But it also helps us to pursue one of the bigger ambitions that we have. Having over the last 2 years sat on lots of different boards and gone to lots of different meetings about head and neck cancer research, and then always asking the question about tongue cancer and specifically tongue cancer research for young patients, I have sadly had to come to the conclusion that we're not on the list. We don't make the list by a long cut. So in order to make that change, we're going to have to do it ourselves. So Oracle Cancer Trust has a lot of experience in funding head and neck cancer research, and some of our fundraising efforts will go into a pot that is earmarked specifically for tongue cancer research that will benefit the young patient population. And that means better data, which means it will allow us to identify the differences between cavity tongue cancer, oropharyngeal cancer, and base of tongue cancer. We also are having a big discussion about HPV, HPV positive, HPV negative. We know that 90% of oropharyngeal cancers are HPV positive, but only 10% of cavity tongue cancer are HPV positive. Yet within our community, we are seeing a growth of more people with cavity tongue cancer, which are HPV negative. So again, we're sort of going against the big headlines at the moment. So we have to keep reminding people that, yes, investing into HPV research is really important, but we also need to find out what's happening in the HPV negative space, because there is a growth. But in order to prove that there is a growth, we need good, reliable data.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. No, that's certainly very interesting. And like you say, the HPV story is a headline in sounds like it's in two different directions there.
Absolutely. And speaking of headlines, it's really important to make this point that raising awareness of tongue cancer is crucial. And recently, their oral cancer has featured a lot more in the media, which is fantastic. But it's really important that we use those opportunities wisely. There was a few months ago for Mouth Cancer Action Month, there was a really great report on oral cancer on BBC Breakfast, followed by an interview with a dentist. And unfortunately, that dentist used some very unwise words, and I will tell you what they are and how they impacted. I must admit, I emotionally was really impacted by this. So I wasn't able to think very clearly at the time, but I must admit, initially when I heard the interview, I just thought, where on earth did they pull this man in from? And when I researched, I was quite surprised to see that this was actually a dentist with lots of experience and really actually someone that is an expert. So again, I was even more worried about the messaging happening. So when the interviewer asked him, why is there an increase in oral cancers? The answer given was, oh, because people smoke, they drink too much, and in general, they don't look after themselves. This messaging had two negative impacts. Firstly, the people watching will disengage. They will go, that's not me. I brush my teeth. I look after myself. I don't smoke. Oh, I've got an ulcer. It's probably something else. Really, really important that we get the messaging right across the board, and that anyone in this space that wants to promote oral cancer, that we are all using the same language. And I understand why we want to highlight why smoking and drinking and lifestyle choices have an impact on oral cancer. But we also need to remember that there's now a growing patient population that this does not apply to. Mm-hmm. And by solely mentioning lifestyle choices and HPV, we are neglecting the other group. And the second big impact this statement had was on our patient population. I cannot stress the detrimental effect that statement had on our community. The people were genuinely really upset and embarrassed, and a lot of shame there, because they felt someone has just gone on national TV and told everyone that I know that I have caused my own cancer. So again, I think we need to be really careful with the way we message. And also on the flip side, you know, if we have someone who has a persistent ulcer or a lump or something, we're not really encouraging them to go and see their dentist or GP by announcing you've probably caused this. So again, I think we just need to really rethink the way we communicate this. There's a second example. The day after, our lovely Lorraine on ITV headlines. I mean, it's a great headline, and I understand why the media would pick up on it. But for for someone to put on their TV and the headline across the bottom of the screen being oral sex linked to oral cancer is not helpful. Because again, we are, well, if we want to talk about it technically, HPV is passed on not just by oral sex, it's anal sex, vaginal sex, and also French kissing. But we know that wouldn't make a great headline. But again, in terms of the detrimental impact it has on the existing patient population, is people are embarrassed, they have shame. STIs are a deeply personal thing. And come with a lot of stigma attached to them. So again, I think as a community, we need to rethink how we communicate this. And not just, I mean, I'm talking about reactions here from mostly white Western women. Other cultures will have a much more bigger reaction to something like, and will not want to be associated with something that could have to do with an STI. So again, we need to think deeply about how we tackle this communications problem.
Well, there's a lot of different things to think about, and it's been really helpful to hear your perspective on those things, because yeah, the phrases that we use are very important, and we might not necessarily always understand that. I guess the kind of logical question from here is, what's next? What's next for you? We're in the early stages of this charity. You've obviously used your experiences for good in such a great way. What are your kind of plans going forward?
Yes, so I've just finished my vision for the next, to take us through the next year, then 5 years, and then 10 years. I have always been quite an ambitious person, so I'm slightly scared about everything we signed ourselves up to.
Well, I've got to aim high.
And yes, we are most definitely aiming high. We have some really specific things that we would like to achieve. And I'll just give you one, for example, just so I don't get carried away. But if you bring up the topic of biopsies within our community, there'll be a really big uproar, because the pain relief we receive when we have the biopsy is inadequate. You have the local anaesthetic, the biopsy is done, and then you're told, oh, if you want to drive, you can, but probably you shouldn't, and have some paracetamol and ibuprofen. I can tell you from my own experience that paracetamol and ibuprofen is not, it doesn't work. I'm trying to be polite here and not swear. We need something stronger. And the reason this is really important, because you think, oh, it's a biopsy and then it's over and you're fine. The experience of having, feeling like a bus has punched you in the face for 8 hours straight will leave you with fear. And then if you're then diagnosed with tongue cancer and you know that the hard stuff is just in front of you, and you're already petrified of pain because you've seen what a biopsy can already cause, has a huge impact on patients in terms of how mentally prepared they are for the rest. And also it's totally unnecessary, you know, just prescribe proper pain medication in order to take care of it. In the most extreme of all cases, and I count myself in this, is that 9 months after my surgery, I was diagnosed with PTSD-like symptoms caused by the biopsy, because I cannot enter the room where my biopsy took place without vomiting and then having a really bad mental health storm after. Totally avoidable, totally unnecessary. And actually, if we think of the grand scheme of what I've been through, the biopsy was the tiny bit. So so we have lots of things, a long list of small, I feel, small practical things. I have now also learned from my naivety that trying to fix these small practical things is actually way more complicated. And I feel like I've only just sort of lifted the hood of the car to see underneath and gone, oh my goodness, where do we start? So I think if you're listening to this podcast and you have, you're working and you have power within the NHS or in the dentistry, or you feel like, oh, actually, we would love to speak to Barbara and hear her ideas and point me in the right direction of where we can make that kind of change happen, please get in contact with us, you can find us on Instagram at Young Tongues Global or on our website, which is www.youngtonguesglobal.com.
And I'm sure we'll be putting those in the episode notes for everybody to go look at if they want to.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for coming on the podcast. It's been a real privilege to have you share your story, really. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
If you've been inspired by that episode, did you know that the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre provide training for the whole dental team? Follow us on social media or search for the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre to find out more.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. We would love to hear your suggestions for future guests. Remember to follow us on social media using hashtag the Eastman Dental Podcast. And if you like what you hear, please like, share, subscribe, and listen out for future episodes.